BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show Friday Drive Time with me, Tony Gosling, and old Labour economist Martin Summers. When fat cats get so rich they can afford as many fast cars, mansions, servants, drugs, high-class prostitutes as they want, what do they crave then? Political power? How impervious is democracy, political parties and the media to their bribes? And might secret societies be hard at work behind the curtain, infiltrating positions in the civil service as a secret state, that is, the permanent government, by stealth? And after the tragic death or murder of musician Smiley Culture, who died in a police raid 10 days ago, we get the latest from his nephew Merlin Emmanuel. But first, the referendum on the new AV voting system's coming up in about a month's time. But what is AV and is it better than what we've got? Well, let's have a listen to some of the arguments for and against it. Now, Martin and Billy are still here with me. Martin Summers, Martin, you're actually quite pro-AV, aren't you? You're one of the people that thought it was going to be a great idea. Well, can you just explain, first of all, why you think it's a good idea?
Well, I mean, I'd rather have a system like the Irish system, which is a properly proportional system. AV is a halfway house, but it's but we've got to have it, because otherwise we're going to carry on doing silly things in a silly way.
Well, silly things in silly ways, but how is it actually going to make a practical difference?
It means, for example, that instead of the argument, there's only about 100,000 people who decide elections in Britain. They're all in the suburbs of London, and everything's got to revolve around the pea brains of these people. In Ireland, everybody can go to the electorate and say, well, I'm Fianna Gael, I'm Fianna Fáil, I'm Sinn Féin, and people can choose what they really want, and then the Irish over many years have understood how everybody understands how it works. It's not that complicated, and it means that the system is very flexible and very they didn't get the right result in the last election, I think, in Ireland, but nevertheless people had a real choice, which we don't have.
Well, you say everyone understands it, but they certainly don't here in England yet, and Britain anyway. Billy, can you just give us in a nutshell why you think that the AV is going to be a bit of a disaster and we're going to be going the wrong direction by emulating the sort of coalition style Irish politics?
Well, Martin flagged up the fact that Ireland has a proportional representation system of electing a government, which it does, and we were left that as a legacy by the British in 1932 when they pulled out finally. The idea behind it then was, as it still is today, to divide and rule. That if they leave behind them a legacy of confusion and of no strong leadership or no single mandated party having the thrust to be able to carry the whole nation behind it by literally saturating the market with choice.
But the trouble is, Billy, a lot of people see the party and party politics as the problem, and that individual parties are not the way. It's actually that the only way to actually invigorate these parties is to get them to do deals with other parties.
I'm afraid it won't ever work. The one thing, and I will bring you back again to Nick Clegg signing a charter to not raise tuition fees early on in his election campaign. The first thing he did, the minute he parked his buttocks on the seat of power, was to do away with his pledge and knock tuition fees, which they say to a maximum of £9,000. I mean, what university is going to say, oh yeah, well, we're not good enough to charge £9,000? Why do they bother giving a banding? Anyway, that's another issue. The long and short of it is, there was a civil war in Britain in the 1640s or so, all to do with one man, one vote. This idea of AV or proportional representation is that every single candidate, well, you have 10 choices. You have 10 votes that you cast when you go to the poll. You cast it in order of preference from 1 to 10. 1 being the person that you most want elected, number 10 being the person that you would like to see them getting their deposit back.
That's not AV. I mean, that's proportional.
That's proportional as we operate in Ireland.
In Ireland, what I like about the Irish system is you've got these big multi-member constituencies where you elect 3 TDs for Cork or whatever it is.
Yes.
Yeah. And in actual fact, it means that there is a very strong local link Yeah, because if you're a Fianna Fáil voter, you'll go to your Fianna Fáil man. You know, I mean, you can tell me what happens in Cork. You get one Fianna Fáil, one Fianna Gael, and one other. Labour, Sinn Féin, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And it means that the politics is very fluid.
Yes, exactly. So what you're voting for, when you go to the polls on election day, what you actually mark on your card and say, I'm voting for that guy because he says he's going to do this, none of it ever comes to fruition because it is this constant horse trading and dilution of what he said he wanted to do, and the reason that you put him in power to carry out your mandate, which you empowered him with, just doesn't get done, and everybody is sucking from the fattening calf of public finance.
I guess what you're saying is, I mean, it's actually more likely to be these sort of betrayals that happened with the Lib Dems, when on the one hand Clegg was making a pledge not to cut, not to increase tuition fees, where actually behind the door he'd done a deal with David Cameron, deal, saying, well, actually, if we go into coalition together, we will be up for upping the tuition fees. So, Martin, how do you answer that? That he actually is encouraging politicians to do shady deals behind the scenes before the election?
No, because if everybody knows how the system works, people know that that's what will the end result. I mean, I think Fianna Gael should have turned around and told the banks to get stuffed, but they didn't, and but they will be punished. Their own people will not support that, and there's a very flexible system which will allow that to happen. And don't forget, we've only got peace in the north of Ireland, 3PR, and we used to have first past the post in the six counties, and the loyalists won every election because they're the majority. And of course, very important part of the peace process was, say, hang on a minute, we've got to have everybody's voice has got to be heard here.
How do you answer that, Billy? That's quite a good point, isn't it?
Well, it may have worked for them then because they were flinging grenades at each other and bombing one another in their homes. I don't really see that happening in Bradley Stoke at the moment. And also, I mean, the bringing together of the great minds, or Bert and Ernie, of Northern Irish politics, frankly, it stopped people getting killed, but I wouldn't ever use that as a political model on how to run a country. I think if Britain is to move forward successfully, I don't see a problem with what they have been doing quite successfully for the last 300 years, that if you pay your tax, you are entitled to a vote, you get one, and however you choose to use it, that will carry forward into the government of the next 4 years, 5 years, well, which comes back to the point I was making earlier. The leader of the opposition hasn't been a role that's been fully fulfilled or successfully fulfilled for an awfully long time in this country.
Okay, Martin, do you want to just come back there? Because you were straining
I mean, I'll just say that in Wales and Scotland, they've got PR for their elections, and it will come in the end. Every other Northern European country has got it. Ireland's got it. Scandinavia's got it. The only place that has faced past the post other than Britain is the United States of America.
I can't see why you're such a fan of it, because at least I know politicians aren't to be trusted, and nor will they ever be to be trusted, but at least if you have a first past the post system, you can turn around to Nick Clegg and his constituency and call him a liar to his face, and he will have no comeback at you.
Well, I mean, we're not going to agree about this. I find it extraordinary because there is no way whatever that the Irish are going to change their electoral system. And I actually like the Irish electoral system. If I was to have a choice, I would like a similar system for Britain.
Well, the argument for the British system, as it currently is first past the post, is you tend to get a decisive government with one party winning rather than having
less compromises. Yes, but it's not a game of football. It's actually it's not a question of one party winning. We've got to get the right results. If we'd had a PR system in this country, we wouldn't have gone to war in Iraq. Absolutely not.
You think that's true, Billy?
No, absolutely not. Because Tony Blair was there in a majority government, and if you cast your mind back, the Tory front bench also supported his incursion into Iraq. And while we're speaking on incursions and foreign occupancy, I know we're coming to Libya presently, but I would like to report that Britain has sat back miraculously lethargically over Darfur in Sudan and over the Ivory Coast, purely because they don't have oil.
Well, just keeping us to the discussion about AV, actually, the system works quite, if you look at a ballot paper, it's quite similar to the ordinary ballot paper with all the names of the candidates. You just rank 1, 2, 3. And I can't understand why people who like first past the post, like yourself, Billy, don't like the AV system. Because if you want to vote with the first past the post kind of system, you just put number one and you only use that one vote and you're voting for that candidate and nobody else.
Exactly. But by doing
so, in a way, with the AV system, it's a bit the best of both worlds.
Yeah, but that's one of the arguments. However, if you're given 10 options and there's half a dozen people at the end of the list, the independents, that you know are going to struggle to get their deposit back at the very least, you're always going to give those fellas a vote because at least they were prepared to stand up and be counted. And stick their own money into the pot to have their opinions on the same platform as the fat cats who are being bankrolled by big business. So I will always, in an AV situation, and that's how, I hate to go back to it, Screaming Lord Sutch came in and revolutionised the drinking habits of British at weekends, purely because he guaranteed all day opening on a Saturday and a Sunday. And I know it's a long time ago, and I know he was a novelty candidate, but there's that guy up in Wolverhampton at the moment, the consultant, who was elected as an independent. He was a single issue candidate on keeping the hospital open up there. It does actually, you can still get these anomalies through into the British Parliament with a first past the post system. However, the idea of having a large-scale protest vote, which is being diluted and spread across 10 different candidates, and people are getting it, it's just so vastly open to corruption.
But isn't the problem with the present system is that, that there's lots of times that people are voting tactically. They're voting with their heads and not with their hearts. They're voting for somebody because they think that they are the best person to stop the person they don't want. That's what's going on at the moment.
Well, that's why we've got Lib Dems in a leveraged position at the moment, because, let's be honest, although Clegg was pretty good in the first televised debate, the Lib Dem vote was a protest vote, because there is still a huge post-Thatcherite hangover against the Conservatives in this country. And since Tony Blair dragged you into an illegal war in Iraq and turned to be the offspring of Satan in the latter part of his tenure, and Gordon Brown managed to empty out the coffers and the Bank of England, which I would like to remind everybody, he sold the gold reserves of the country for less than $300 an ounce, and it's now up over $1,200 an ounce on the back of his house of cards he created in the City of London, which, as you were saying earlier, Britain is exposed to £200 billion of Irish debt. That's because of the free rein that he gave the city for the 10 years he was the Chancellor. He deregulated the whole thing.
That's why I want PR, because what actually happens is that the city and the military run this country, and we have supposed elections where we vote Labour, but it's not Labour. We don't. What we need is, I'm a bit of a rugby fan, we need a blindside option. So Blair was turning around to us as the grassroots of the Labour Party, says, it's me or the Tories. I say, oh, what I want to say to Blair is, no, it's not.
Martin, this system, you know, if and when it does come in, do you think it's really going to be a tremendous amount of difference? Because actually, we're still going to be dealing with the same political parties, and there's just sort of basic lack of vision. There's a lack of vision, and there's quite a similarity between a lot of the policies of the Lib Dems and the New Labour, the previous Labour government, and the Conservatives.
Well, that's because it's all decided by 100,000 voters in the swing voters in the London suburbs. That's how our system works. Yeah, they voted Thatcher, then they voted Blair, and it's just ridiculous, because the inner cities, for example, don't get a voice in this. They don't get a voice. I think it's great that Sinn Féin got 14 people elected.
Why don't inner cities get a voice?
Because they had a clean sweep in Dublin, didn't they?
Why don't inner cities get a voice?
Because the Labour Party ends up being, you've got to vote for us, because we're the only alternative to the Conservatives, but we are going to be very conservative ourselves. Now, what we need to see is a true spread of opinion. There's at least 25% of the people in this country who are very, very radical, and we never hear their voices, and that's why we need PR.
Well, how will PR actually bring those voices out?
It means that people can stand up and say, vote for me on your first choice. But in France, they don't have PR, but they do have two round elections, yeah? So the left and the right fight it out in the first round with each other.
Yes.
And then in the second round, it's decided.
And then you have the likes of Le Pen, who's garnering 30% of the electorate.
That's a shame, isn't it?
Martin,
there's nothing we can do about that.
I also point out to you that Belgium, because of PR, hasn't had an operational government for over a year now, because of the horse trading and the failure to create a feasible coalition.
That's because you know, Bosnia is still a mess, because you've got all these problems, haven't you? It's not actually a state, but Belgium is a bit like Bosnia, where you've got one third of Serbs who don't want to be in it. You know, these are real problems. PR is normal in Scandinavia, in Finland, in Sweden, in Denmark, normal stuff. And they are very well organised, those people, very well organised. They don't have private bloody prisons.
Okay, Billy, let's give you the final word, since Marty's been swearing.
You know, I'm not sure that I deserve it now, because
no,
I'm not prepared to swear on air.
You don't have to.
Well, the long and short of it is, at least when you go to the polls now, with your one man, one vote, you get what you pay for.
Thanks very much, you two, for helping us discuss AV, and let's see how it all goes at the referendum at the same time as our local elections at the beginning of May.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with me, Tony Gosling, and Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, and Saturday morning arts show presenter Billy Quain. Well, right at the start of the NATO campaign against Gaddafi's Libya, hundreds of millions of pounds worth of the Libyan assets were seized by the US and also by European banks, which belong to the Libyan people. According to former banker Mohamed Rafiq from London think tank Global Vision 2000, this money may now have been stolen by Western interests and may never be seen again.
I'm going to be specifically talking about the political economy. Historically, there were sanctions on Libya that were voted for within the UN. Those sanctions were put in place through law. This $100 billion which has been seized of Libyan money, no UN resolution was passed. The United States has acted completely independently without any other country being involved in the freezing of these assets other than they requested it. So they've been unlawfully seized. In the same way, we've had the situation with Ben Ali and Mubarak. When Mubarak moved these assets into London, he's been able to smuggle them out of the UK and into Saudi. And we have a situation when the Muslims do eventually manage to get some kind of interim Islamic democracy in their respective states, they're going to need this money back. And we have to start keeping our eye on this ball now, because this will turn into, the old find the lady under the cup. By the time the Muslims get into power, this money will have been moved and distributed throughout the world and put into different structures and different names, and it's theft. This money belongs to the people of those countries, not their leaders. That is state money, and it needs to be repatriated. What my biggest concern in all of this smokescreen of the revolutions which are going on is that in the middle of all of this and the fog of war, that these people are going to steal the cash.
Martin, let's start with you here. First of all, that's Mohamed Rafiq there from London think tank Global Vision 2000. Do you think that this cash may be stolen? Is this really something we need to worry about? Because I've not heard about this before.
Well, it's possible. I mean, obviously, it's a very fast developing situation. So we have to watch news bulletins to keep up.
Well, this
with
is
it.
about a month ago. About 3 weeks ago, these assets were seized.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of people out there in the world at large do not believe that Britain is intervening in Libya for humanitarian reasons. Whether we are or whether we aren't, the fact is that most people think we're doing it for venal reasons, and they've got good reason to think that.
Billy,
well, do you trust bankers? And do you honestly think that if there was £600 million that you knew Gaddafi couldn't walk into the bank and withdraw any time before he gets bumped off, what would you do with it?
Well, what Mohamed Rafiq's suggesting there is that what happens is this money is then sort of moved around, and then when the people, a new government, comes together and comes back to the West and says, "We want our money back now," they say, "Well, I'm sorry, we'll have
money."
To
pay. Money?
It depends what the government does. If they're good little boys, then they'll get the money, and if they're bad boys, they won't.
I very much doubt they're going to find any money at all. But there again, I mean, this whole thing, it really stinks, and I don't mean to upset listeners by speaking plainly about it, but the UN had no business going in there. They had no business creating a no-fly zone mandate, which they're then using to bomb strategic targets, as they call them. We were talking about £100 million disappearing from the Arts Council budget. I think 4 days of bombing in Libya is that £100 million straight back again for the arts. It absolutely stinks. It's purely because Libya has oil. Tony Blair did a deal with Gaddafi when he said, yes, I'm discontinuing my endeavour to create weapons of mass destruction. Not that he ever was anyway, because the one thing about Gaddafi, he's a very convincing liar.
Martin, what about this? Because it's becoming much more than a no-fly zone, isn't it? It's not. We were told this and sold it, really, this UN resolution, it being a resolution which would stop Gaddafi using his planes and bombers.
Well, it's becoming very complex. I must say that I'm in two minds about this. I really am.
It stinks.
I think it stinks as well. I think the motivation's wrong. But on the other hand, if I was a Libyan rebel with a gun in my hand facing a tank from Gaddafi, I might want an airstrike. I mean, I was an aid worker in Bosnia in the 90s, and there was a no-fly zone above our heads being put in place by the UN. And frankly, I was pleased with that. But of course, it didn't actually. I mean, the fighting went on. A no-fly zone doesn't mean fighting's ended. Yeah. And what they're doing, of course, is knocking out Gaddafi's tanks and so on.
Do you
and of
think
course, the Russians and the Chinese saying, "Oh, you're intervening in the civil war here"?
Do you think that the people, then there are considerable numbers of people in Libya that support Gaddafi, are going to support this the West in now they're bombing Tripoli?
It doesn't behove us sitting in a studio in Bristol to say what the Libyan people should or shouldn't do. It's for them to decide. Gaddafi clearly has some support.
That's actually not what I asked you. I asked you if you think that they will continue to support the West if we bomb Tripoli, which we're doing now.
Who will support the West?
The people who currently support Gaddafi.
Well, I mean, the rebels initially said they didn't want any outside intervention. And then, of course, they were getting whipped, and therefore they said, "Well, bring in airstrikes for us." As I was over Bosnia, I'm genuinely split about this. I don't believe in interfering in other people's countries at all, by and large.
If we look at the number of civilians who have died in Iraq, I know this is maybe not the best example, but the number of civilians who have died in Iraq since the removal of Saddam Hussein from power is more than 10 times the number of civilians who died, including Kurds, while he was in power.
I totally agree with you, and this is what the Turks are making this point, is that your intervention is actually going to lead to more civilian casualties rather than less. And I am listening to that voice, but I'm genuinely listening. I don't know where I am on this one at the moment.
Thanks, guys. We're on to looking at Smiley Culture and his first single, Cockney Translation, following the tragic death of black musician Smiley Culture while he was being raided by police 10 days ago. Let's have a little reminder of his contribution, always light-hearted, to the 1980s music scene, with this Jamaican's guide to the traditional Cockney East End slang.
11 10 9 8 7 6 5 4 3 2 1 It's I, Smiley Culture, with the mic in my hand. Me come to teach you right, Anna. Not the wrong in the Cockney translation. Cockney's not a language, it is only a slang, and was originated, so in England. The first place it was used was over East London. It was respect for the different style pronunciation, but it wasn't really used by any and any man. This is strictly con man, also the villain, but through me full up of lyrics and education, like you know you are gonna get a little translation. Cockney have names like Terry Arthur and Del Boy. We have names like Winston, Lloyd and Leroy. We ball out, yo, while Cockney say, oi. Well, Cockney call a Jacks, we call a Blue Boy. Say Cockney have mates while we have spar. Say Cockney live in a drum while we live in a yard. Say we get nyam while Cockney get captured. Say Cockney say gavna with a big boat, yeah. In a the Cockney translation, in a the Cockney translation. Well, watch a man, the translation of Cockney to understand is easy. So long as you don't dip and you listen me keenly, you should pick it up like a you to find some money. Go tell it to your friends, also your family. No matter if a English or a Yardie, cause you never know when them might buck up a Cockney. Remember one, them and them down easy. Them no fire slingshot and miss it strictly double B. Them run protection racket and control no CID. Say Cockney fire shoot, we bust man. Say Cockney say tea leaf, we just a sticks man. You know them have wedge while we have corn. Say Cockney say big first man done, we just a guan. Say Cockney say grass, we say old farmer man. When them talk about iron, them really mean bottom man. Rookin and chopperita, me say Cockney call Tom. Say Cockney say out bill, we say dirty Babylon. In a the Cockney translation, in a the Cockney translation. Well, watch a man, slam bam, jam on, hear them, fashion, smiley, culture, origination. But first, let me tell you more about the Cockney, who live comfortably and have them yacht by the sea. And when it comes to money, most of them have plenty. But when them spend it in the bookie, lose it all on the dogs or on the GGs, or paying off for them bribes to the Sweeney. So them now go do no time for no arm robbery, or catching anything that fell off the back of a lorry. Slam bama, jamana, hear them fashiona, me stronger, me longer, me at the mic sana. More time in a dance, me chat, panatone, but sometimes me shake out and leave me hometown. And that's when me travel at East London, where I have to speak as a different man, so that the Cockney can understand. So black man and white man, hear them fashion, Cockney says scare. We scatter, Cockney say rabbit, we chatter. We say bleach, Cockney knock hard. Cockney say terrific, we say wakad. Cockney say blouts, we say guys. Cockney say alright, we say ice, we say pants. Cockney say stride, sweet as a nut. Just level vibes, sin.
from 1984. That was Cockney Translation from reggae artist Smiley Culture, who died in a Metropolitan Police raid on his home a week before last. Well, I spoke yesterday to Merlin Emmanuel, who's Smiley Culture's nephew.
I am Merlin Emmanuel. I'm Smiley's nephew. My mum is his sister.
Now, what about the legal situation surrounding Smiley? Because I understand that he was on some charges.
Firstly, yes, he had a pending case. He was very confident of being acquitted, and so were his legal team. It was also strange that they actually raided his home about 4 days before the actual hearing, which is not normal protocol. But irregardless of what people may think or may not think, he should have been afforded that protection when they raided his home. Let's say, by some strange circumstance, that what we've heard from the Met thus far is true, well then, in that case, they'd still be held responsible for failing to look after Smiley whilst in their custody. So there are some obvious and blatant mistakes in procedure, which they will have to address in due course.
It does sound a very strange thing to happen, that somebody would actually commit suicide, effectively, in the middle of a police raid.
Yeah, and don't forget, he was seen 20 minutes before in calm demeanour, absolutely fine, and shrugged his shoulders by a family member who came back 20, 25 minutes later and he was dead. So he's gone from one mood and demeanour to another that seems demented and almost chaotic. We don't know what could have took place for something like that to have changed his state of mind.
But there is actually quite a big campaign, particularly in London, about deaths in police custody, particularly of ethnic minorities.
Smiley is obviously falls under that unfortunate and tragic banner, but we must also realise that there are many that came before that have not been afforded the platform, media-wise, that Smiley has been. So we also have to fight for those, black and white, because it seems like a simple two-tier state, meaning that, you know, those in power and those that enforce power seem to be protected by the judicial system, and those poor, underprivileged, the average citizen, us, seem to feel that the system works against us in such cases.
Now, the statistics are something like 400 deaths in custody over the last 10 years without a single prosecution of a policeman. What conclusion do you draw from that?
Well, the conclusion I draw is that there's very little to be confident in as far as regards the process, the judicial process, and the bodies that are set in place to protect the interests of the common citizen, such as the IPCC.
So given that there are problems with the IPCC, how would you like to see it improved?
Yes, I'm actually getting a statute together along with the members of the community and a barrister that's learned in law. And, I mean, here's some ideas. These are ideas that have yet to be passed and actually put into a robust mandate. But, for instance, we believe that if you're IPCC, you should not have been an ex-police officer or had any involvement with law enforcement or government because it's a conflict of interest. We also think that any officer found, this is my ideas, any officer that's involved in a mysterious death under police custody should be immediately suspended until an inquiry has been fully carried out.
Another thing, of course, is that if we go back to the 80s and the riots in Brixton, in St Paul's here in Bristol, in Toxteth in Liverpool, places like that, one of the causes of that, which is constantly cited, is the mistreatment in police custody of inmates. So do you think anything's changed in the last 25 years?
No, I think the system's a lot more efficient. It's less blatant in its actions. It's got a greater hold and manipulation of the media, and it's protected even more so by the judicial system, so that a lot of the injustices go unseen or unchallenged. I think that we are in the same position, and I think it's obvious when you see cases like Smiley and Ian Tomlinson that nothing's changed. The United Friends and Families campaign is a different campaign, although obviously we embrace the sentiment of their campaign. This campaign is called Campaign for Justice for Smiley Culture. But it's also, I mean, that's the Facebook name. Smiley Culture is the catalyst for it, for that momentum. But we stand on the shoulders of those who have gone before us in these kind of tragic circumstances. And we hold their tragedy just as dear to us as we hold our own and my own uncle Smiley.
Now, you were brought up with him. Could you just tell us a bit about, you know, your upbringing with Smiley?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was brought up in Stockwell, near Brixton, and then we grew up at Lansdowne Green Estate. He lived with us for a few years when my gran went to Guyana. And he was a great big brother. He was a mentor. He was an uncle. He led by example. I was brought up in a hip-hop generation and ended up in music. I had my first top 10 when I was 15. As a consequence of being around my uncle and him inspiring me. And then obviously he went on and wasn't so involved in music, but he was still an inspiration in that he was doing lots of great business deals and stuff. So he was always somebody to go to for advice.
The other thing I've heard in some of the commentary about Smiley was that he was a very generous man.
Yes, he was. He always afforded time to anybody that asked, and he was actually injecting some of his wealth back into the community. He had a lot of great plans in how he was going to help the community and the greater. He was a good man to all extents and purposes, and you know, our main objective of this from a personal level is to protect his legacy, that when his name is spoken, one thinks of him in a dignified manner that he deserves.
Your campaign for justice for Smiley, you're marching, I believe.
Yes, April the 16th from South Bank Centre, 12 o'clock, to Scotland Yard. And we've got people from all over the country, in fact the world, giving support and are coming. We've got people flying over from Australia, New Zealand, so no one's got any excuses. We need you all there to support us in this most noble of causes.
Now, around one person a week, particularly ethnic minorities, die in police custody. So families have set up a campaign which marches on Downing Street every autumn. And that was Emmanuel, Merlin Emmanuel, who's the nephew of Smiley Culture. In 2002, a film was banned about deaths in custody, and it was made by director Ken Fearn. You can find that film and watch parts of it on the internet if you want to at www.injusticefilm.co.uk. At least it was a couple of showings of it where there was attempts to ban that. And you can find the United Friends of Family campaign at uffcampaign.net on the internet. That's uff.campaign.net. And they have already said that they have no confidence whatever in the police complaints procedures. So, and finally, on Facebook, there is a campaign, as Merlin mentioned there, the Justice for Smiley Culture campaign on Facebook, which you can join.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Well, it's a bit depressing hearing about Smiley's death, but there is plenty of good stuff going on still. Let's not forget that. The Kaiser Report, for example, twice a week on Freeview Channel Russia Today, and 10 o'clock live on Thursdays on Channel 4. I don't know if you saw that last night. It was a bit of a cracker. And there are two examples of TV actually worth watching. The media in general, the music industry in particular, does seem to be going downhill fast, and I'm joined to try and help revive it by Tim Herford from the local band The Transpersonals. Hi Tim, welcome to Drive Time.
Well, thanks Tony.
Now you've just had an album out on the 11th of March. We're going to hear a little bit from that in a minute. Just to tell us about how much effort goes into putting out an album these days.
Well, we kind of do everything ourselves, so to speak. We're on a small label with no money, so the fun part is making it, and then you've got to actually get it out there to people and try and reach an audience. So there's a lot of work goes into it, but it's all good fun.
And do you think it's actually possible to run a band and actually produce some pretty good music on very little money nowadays?
Yes. You just have to change your point of view or the way you look at how a record should sound. It doesn't matter if you what you record it on or how you record it, you can always make the way that it sounds, you know, like, well, that's how it's meant to sound.
So
do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, what sort of headspace is your band in at the moment, and what kind of direction do you think you're taking?
I write the songs basically, and I've been writing a lot of songs, and this album's very songy, so it's got a lot of songs on it, right? But now we're moving more into the music, which is what I feel we are more of a band when we just play. So it's almost going a bit kind of like jazz.
Okay, what about subject matter, and why are you called The Transpersonals?
Right, the subject matter is I It's called the... Well, okay, let's start with why is it called the transpersonals?
Okay, I'll ask the question the way around, yeah.
Yeah, the transpersonals is... there's transpersonal psychology, which is kind of like the study of experiences which go beyond the normal modes of perception and thought of yourself. So think of it like religious experiences, and I'm very interested in everything, really curious about everything, and the content really is... all coming from trying to come from how I imagine those transpersonal domains to be, and some kind of limited experience of those domains.
So is it
myself,
sort of like escapism? That's almost what you're saying, like getting out of yourself and becoming someone else, but going somewhere else in your mind.
Well, it is a kind of escapism, but there's it's like how you view the word escapism. It's not like a negative thing, like you're trying to escape.
Because you can always escape in rather than out.
Well, that's kind of what we're doing, but you go in, but in is out, do you know what I mean? You one programs the other kind of thing. So it's a very... the fundamental questions in life about what, you know, when you get curious about these things and you start to look at life and yourself, and a mystery unfolds in front of you, which is a very real living mystery, because it's, you know, nobody knows anything more than you do. That's what you kind of find out in the end. Do you know what I mean? I mean,
so you sort of, it's the idea that actually you're, rather than being just completely blinded by all this potential creativity that you could be doing out there, you're focusing down on something which is actually a kind of personal experience and a personal journey of some sort.
Yeah, because I only have my... I am trapped within my own reality tunnel, so to a certain degree. I only have my own life, and I really value the experience of my life. So I love to try and bring the inside out through the band. So I kind of like give birth to my soul into the world. Do you know what I mean?
Okay, so...
I don't think I've achieved that, really.
Well, you're on the way there, maybe. What about the music industry? I mean, do you think it's really able to pick up? Because, I mean, this is something I really sort of kicked off this little session today with, saying, well, look, music industry is going to be going right downhill. Is that your own experience?
Well, my experience is that I've always kind of remained pretty much down the bottom of the hill myself anyway. So I don't have any experience of being like right in the midst of being on a major label, right? So I've always seen the music industry. Now I've got into the flow of doing, realizing that like what I do I've stopped trying to be famous and all this kind of stuff, and just focused on actually enjoying the process of making music. Ever since then, I've realized that the music industry really isn't interested in that. That takes care of itself. Like anything valuable becomes kind of almost, you have to go and find it. Do you know what I mean?
So what's pumped out
is just, we're getting it does go into weird territory,
but I wonder whether you think that actually real talent is actually getting on that conveyor belt out to the general public. In the way that it should be these days, because I mean, my impression is, just generally, is that actually the quality of the stuff that we're hearing in the charts nowadays is pretty dire compared to, say, even, you know, sort of 20-30 years ago.
Well,
unimaginative.
I would say, you know, to stop assuming that you've got to rely upon some industry that's out there to get your music out there is the thing to get over. Do you know what I mean? I mean, you can make your music, and you can get it to people, and people can listen to it. You don't... it's only if you want to be on the actual television screen and have that level of fame and money, you know, which is what most people regard as success, is how famous is it and how much money is it making. But success to me is I think I've done a good job on that album there, and I really like it.
Well, we haven't listened to it any second, but I mean, what about this whole the other thing, which is that the music industry is turning into a bit of a factory where somebody sits in the factory, they get a few session musicians in, they get a lyricist, they get a writer, they get a singer, they get someone, you know, they find some good looking boys, good looking girls, dress them up in costumes, and that's actually the way that a lot of these acts are now put together, rather than groups like yours, which are just basically a bunch of friends that are the creativity is coming from within the group, rather than something which is imposed on there by a sort of factory process.
Well, when you look at the real big money stuff like Lady Gaga and that kind of thing, it looks to me like it still is a very, very, very genuine creative project, but I think it's more based on the glamour side of it, and whereas for a long time it's just been very sexual based with Britney Spears, but when Lady Gaga comes in, you get glamour, but you get a very artistic kind of glamour. Do you know what I mean? A lot of symbology and a lot of and that I think it's still a lot of creativity going on, but it's not so much basically focused on the music. It's more focused on the glamour and the image, and they're selling a kind of idea of style with an attitude and behaviour. So they're really selling a kind of meme, and it's a meme of what young people would want to be. This kind of like
it's
asexual,
quite, you know,
kind
it's potentially
of,
quite manipulative.
Well, it is
isn't
very
it? Because,
manipulative
because
yeah.
you've got their sort of hidden symbolism and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's have a listen to this track off of your album, which was out on the 11th of March. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's called To Find Her Everywhere. Just 3 weeks ago, this is from the Transpersonals, from the album Kiss Goodbye to Free Will, The Perils of Cheerleading. And I'm joined also by the lead singer and songwriter from the Transpersonals, Tim Herford. Tim, your take on particularly on Lady Gaga, because we're going to have a little chat with her, with our next guest, that's Robert Mitchell in a minute. What about Lady Gaga? Where's she coming from?
What about Lady Gaga? I don't. Well, really, I think her videos are really, really interesting. Do you know what I think? They're really well made. It's not like it's a shame. I don't think the music's that good. But there's so much money spent on this stuff that you got to think how is so this is huge. Do you know what I mean? This is a big project. And
they do sort of draw you in. I think the Gaga videos are very, very compelling,
yeah.
And it's almost so intense. I mean, I would my analogy is between you know the sort of a massive amount of special effects that goes into some of these Hollywood films that draw you into watching the screen. But actually, what's being said isn't necessarily all that wonderful. Anyway, I'm also joined by Robert Mitchells from the East Coast US and also from a Freemasonic family. Robert, you're now in Bristol, living in Bristol. How long have you actually been here in Bristol?
Good evening, Tony and Tim. I came here in Bristol in 2007. Circumstances when I came were not that good because I got stuck with my passport stolen and my bank cards and everything. But yeah, you could say I'm now for 3.5-4 years here. Background.
First of all, you've got a bit of a twinge to your US accent. Is that Dutch? A bit of Dutch I can
hear
there?
I lived there for 10, 12 years, yeah, and got too close with the locals. So yeah, never get too close with the locals over there or you lose your accent.
Okay, so you say you're from a Freemasonic family. What does that actually mean, practically, as you're growing up?
If I look to the symbolism, I come from a Freemasonic military family background. When they came from the UK, that was in 1620, from Plymouth with the Mayflower, like many others on both sides. They were grandmasters, and I found later out last year that also my stepfather, whose family came from Holland over 240 years, were Freemasons as well. So in my case, I got it in from three different directions.
But yeah, we often hear that George Washington was a Freemason. Yes. A lot of the founders of the US Constitution, for example,
founding fathers were high degree Freemasons.
So what's the significance of that? Does it actually matter that these people were Freemasons?
Now, when we talk about Freemasons, it doesn't mean that everyone within the Freemasonry wants a world order, what people talk about, because most of the Freemasons, 95% of them, are hanging on the bottom of the pyramid structure within the Freemason, the blue ribbon level, so that it could be the grocery store owner on the corner, your local lawyer in the streets, or your local doctor. When we talk about the top of the Freemasonry, we talk about the bloodline families. We talk about families as the Windsors, the Bush family, the families as the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, and a host of other families.
So why are these? Why do you see these families as somehow different, or are they different?
They are different in certain ways. They are also, what is found out of various research, hybrid bloodlines. With hybrid, what I meant is that they part human and part something else.
Crikey. But anyway, how does this relate, what we were talking about before, to the music industry? Because, I'm aware, I mean, I've got a couple of pictures of Lady Gaga here, and I'm rather annoyed to see that she's got the old SS Zig rune painted on each of her cheeks. So you've got there the symbolism. I mean, when you see the word the SS written as it was back in Nazi Germany, she's got one of those Zig runes just painted on the side of her face, as if that doesn't matter, or it just happens to be there. I find a little bit disturbing. And also, there's a picture of her in her latest concert. I mean, she got some ruby slippers apparently for her birthday this week, and there's a concert in the Grand Garden Arena, Las Vegas, earlier in the week. There she is. Actually, she looks like she's kind of growling. She doesn't actually look as if she's being a particularly nice lady. So what symbolism do you see in this sort of Gaga and maybe possibly other musicians who you think have got some of this symbolism in?
When we look over the last 25 years or so, if it comes to people like Lady Gaga, who is the latest in a whole list of people. We got before her, of course, Britney Spears, who came from the Disney Mind Control Factory, also with Tim, her ex-boyfriend.
Britney Spears comes from a Mind Control Factory. What do you mean?
No, the Disney family is Mind Control. Disney, the Disney Studios, or Disney Concept, is heavily involved in the mind control scene in the US.
So what about Bambi? Hang on a minute. What about Bambi? That's not mind control, is it? I mean, I watched that as a kid and I was crying.
Now, I must still confess that I still like Disney. I'm still a big fan of Disney. So, but they use in certain Disney movies certain subliminals. I found on the internet a pastor in Spain. No, not a pastor, a priest. And he did research into it, and he found shocking to my dismay, as that in certain movies, as one of them was, I think, Little Mermaid, he found a phallus symbol in on the cover hidden. If you look in the right angle, then you saw openly a phallus or a couple of them.
So you think that there's like some sort of subliminal imagery going on there. Now, you've also mentioned to me this thing called Project Monarch in the music industry. What is Project Monarch?
Monarch, that is a CIA MK Ultra mind control project that go back to the Second World War, when the Americans, through Operation Paperclip, got the top scientists in mind control and Joseph Mengele to the US, and they continued from there with their practices onwards. I also talked about another project that I was as a child being used in that project, and that was Montauk, M-O-N-T-A-U-K, Montauk. And that operated under a military base on Long Island, Montauk Point. That's hence for the name that I gave to the project. And that ended up in 1984 when someone unleashed something in the base that smashed up the base, thank God, and they had to stop the project at that time. Montauk is more electronically if it comes to mind control and other things, while Monarch is trauma-based mind control.
Okay, what about keeping this quiet? Because surely this sort of stuff would be much better known about. I mean, how do you think that this sort of thing, if it does go on, is kept quiet?
Yes.
I mean, we'd all know about it, wouldn't we?
Now, there are quite a couple of whistleblowers in various sizes and shapes who are coming out. One of them, is especially about Monarch, is Fritz Springmeier. I'm not sure if you have heard about the name.
Well, these are names we can all have a look on the internet.
Yes,
if we want.
And also, of course, the famous Katie O'Brien. I met her a couple of times in the 90s.
So, what about Kathy? Actually, we had a thing about mind control on this show about 8 months ago with some clips from Kathy. What about her? You say you met her.
Yes, and I think she is the real deal in the sense that what she says is, it's true.
I mean, basically, she was saying, wasn't she, that George Bush Sr. was actually the ruler of America, a kind of king, and that various other presidents were just little princes under him and just told what to do. People like Clinton were just told what to do.
If it comes to the Bush family, they are directly related in line with the Windsors. They are cousins.
Well, with the British royal family?
Yes, with the Windsors.
Well, okay, so...
There was a shift. There was a split in, I think, 1571 when the Bush family, or what became the Bush family, went over to the United States, while what became later the Windsor family stayed here. And the real name of the Bush family goes back to the 12th century in Germany, and that is the name Bauer.
Now, Tim, you're still here with us. Is there anything of this which is familiar to you? Do you think there's any credibility? Do you give any credibility to these ideas?
Well, what's definitely going on, and this is what I find really interesting, is, you know, people used to say, if you go and research the eye in the pyramid on the dollar bill, and it'll lead you down a rabbit hole. Well, you can do that with anything. You can do that with a music video now. And as you, what's definitely happening is that there are... these ideas, connections being made with all sorts of stuff that people are talking about, and all this information is getting spread around, almost like an alternative reality game.
But for many people, they just see this as completely balmy, and so they steer well clear of it.
Well, it may well be completely balmy. It may well be that we're completely balmy.
But
that human beings are balmy. This is what we do.
Is there any truth to it, do you think?
Well, the truth is in the mystery itself, you know? I mean, it just becomes more and more mysterious and more incredible the further down the rabbit hole you go.
Because, I mean, you know, looking at a lot of the Gaga videos, for example, you know, there seems to be some very powerful symbolism in there, and some of these Illuminati symbols.
Yeah.
But do you want to just chip in there, Robert?
All right. Now, when we talk about symbolism, that's all focused on the subconscious mind. And when we talk about what they in the end want, the so-called one world order, that was the same concept, but Hitler wanted as well. And the Nazis, some of them, went through Operation Paperclip to the United States and put their soldiers' uniform out and their business suits on and continued. And the Bush family, they were pro-Nazis.
Now, do you think it's possible that this whole point of this is that actually the idea is it's aimed at our subconscious? So the idea is we can't actually rationalise it because it's talking directly to our innate self. Well, that's why we don't understand where it's coming
except
from.
Except what I think is, I think it is our subconscious. There's nobody in control of the whole thing. It's we're as a species organising ourselves culturally through this kind of communication, which is...
Well, some of it, you know, it could be actually quite manipulative, couldn't it, Rob?
Yeah.
Yes. And if it comes to what they're planning, we are lucky that we still can talk about it in freedom, because when we talk about what is called the Illuminati, there are three main groups, and at the moment they are all in fighting with each other about who will get in power. Thank God for us, to be honest, because that is why we still can talk about it at the moment.
Well, I would say one thing about this whole subject is that there is some actually very good material to on the Illuminati. Just to wind up, first of all, there's a book called Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All the Religions and Governments of Europe, and that was written by John Robison. He was the... You can find all these on sacredtexts.com, by the way. And he was the professor of natural philosophy at Edinburgh University. He's also the secretary of the Royal Society. Back when the Industrial Revolution was first starting, and you may have seen that James Watt, the inventor of the steam engine, had an exhibition that's just opened at the British Museum. And he was a close friend of James Watt, Robison. And Watt invented the steam engine. Robison invented, guess what?
Don't know.
The siren. You know, the air raid siren. Although obviously
you should have had a sound effect cue. You should have just gone...
Well, it would have been, yes, I'm sorry, I didn't.
Sorry
but,
about that.
Yes, hopefully there's no siren sounding right now. But the idea to alert people, it's quite interesting that he wrote that. The other one is Abbé Barrowel, who also wrote another very good book about the Illuminati. All this stuff from source material. So you think it's a credible thing, the Illuminati really is out there, Robert?
Yes, I feel if I also look to my own experiences with being in Montauk, the Illuminati is there. And we can say they are not there.
Okay, well, anyway, we've got to go now, so see you all next week.